In November 2023, I had the honor of being a co-host of the Network to Heal Summit, which was created by Matthias and Doris Badner with fellow co-host Nathaniel Schwartz. The following episode is a taster of the interview which Nathaniel Schwartz did with Dr. Andre Sain. If you enjoy this lecture and would like to purchase the Summit package to have full access to all the lectures plus bonus content, then Matthias has organized a massive discount for my listeners. The package is normally €295, but if you use the code NETWORKTOHEAL200, you will receive a €200 discount, meaning you can get the entire Summit package with bonus content for only €95. To access this, visit www.networktoheal.de. You can then select if you want the website in English or German. Scroll to the bottom of the page where it says secure your conference package now and enter the discount code NETWORKTOHEAL200. Easy peasy. Enjoy the episode.
Very heartfelt welcome to Network to Heal. And our special guest today is Dr. Andre Sain, a teacher, a very experienced prescriber and practitioner, a teacher of generations of homeopaths. Thank you, Andre, for taking time to be with us today.
Oh, you're much welcome, Nate, and welcome to your listener.
Andre, we often in homeopathy are looking at the newest trends and interested in the newest trends, new ideas and new approaches. And one of the things I really appreciate about you is that from the very beginning of your study of homeopathy, you were questioning the beliefs or the what you were being taught. In the sense of wanting to know where is it all coming from and is this really true, all the things that I'm being taught. So you were a homeopath who wanted to look into the history, into what made homeopathy what it is. And a lot of the articles that you've written and things that I've learned from you from the years are what I would call iconoclastic. You know, that there's some kind of a belief and some kind of a theory in homeopathy, and then it gets taught from generation to generation, a little like the soup of the soup of the soup. And this is not a pleasant topic, maybe, because no one likes to have their toes stepped on. But it's good to keep the toes stepped on sometimes because it keeps you nimble and keeps you moving to have a little a hard look at yourself. So I was thinking we would even call this talk with you, we'll call it hard talk on homeopathy. So we're at hard talk with Network to Heal. And one of the things that that a colleague was saying when we were preparing for this conference was all these conferences are often about the future or what's happening now, the newest thing and what's going to happen, the newest trends. What about the past of homeopathy? What is it that we can learn from our past so that we don't repeat the same mistakes, so that we use the knowledge and the resources that have already been created instead of constantly recreating the wheel? So I thought it would be wonderful to talk to you and generally and to talk about one of your favorites, or maybe your very favorite, Adolf zu Lippe.
Okay, very good. Listen, to master a discipline like homeopathy, I have said that many, many times, you should know it from its roots upward. When you look at the history of homeopathy, you don't learn the history of homeopathy for dates and names. It's to develop understanding where you come from, and understanding of what needs to be done now and where need to go in the future. That's the reason we study history. And when I learned homeopathy at the beginning, I realized very, very quickly that when I look in old journal, that the people of the past knew much more than the people today. And when the people tried to reinvent the wheel, they didn't even know about the wheel. They didn't know that there were spikes on wheels before and the that there was no need to repair the wheel because it worked very well. But now people are trying to repair a wheel they don't even know about. So very few people know the history of homeopathy, know the original the practice at the beginning. And if I had to summarize in one or two sentences, it would be at the beginning of homeopathy, there was only one teacher and there was one set of books. It was the one of Hahnemann. And with this set of books and the teaching of Hahnemann as the only teacher, homeopaths, the pioneer homeopaths, had unparalleled success, unprecedented in the history of medicine and unparalleled in the history of homeopathy. After there were new teacher coming in, try to change a bit what Hahnemann had said, or maybe they even read Hahnemann and they knew a bit of homeopathy and they taught it. And success start to go down and other non-Hahnemannian practice start to be introduced. And that was the beginning of the decline of homeopathy. But as long as homeopathy is kept to the Hahnemann method, which is a pure method, pure scientific method, which is very easy to understand. You get the symptom of the patient, you get a totality, you try to get as many symptoms as possible. It's not possible to get all the symptoms, but you try to get as many possible symptoms from the moment the person was born until today, the most characteristic aspect of their person, and all their sensitivity and general symptom. You try to develop a global picture of the patient with their disease. And then you would say, what's most peculiar in this case? And then you would have to find a match for these symptoms. So you have the symptom of the patient and a match in the mathematica. You would use maybe the repertory to help you find the match, but it would be your understanding by reading the mathematica. You'll say, oh, this is the remedy. This, I have the gut feeling for this remedy. So it has to fit like this. There's no theory. There's no tricks. There's no shortcut. Totality of the symptom, find in the mathematica the remedy that is most similar. And the mathematica has to be a mathematica pura, pure from all conjecture, from ideas, from hypothesis. So it's only the pure language of nature, the facts that are have been experienced and reported by the provers, and then supplemented by cure case. So the cure case will supplement, add to the mathematica of the proving, complement it, and even give more avenue that a proving cannot do. For instance, you cannot do a proving on a newborn baby. We don't do proving in pregnant women. We don't do proving in insane people. But now we have symptom cured insane people, and they add to the mathematica. So this is the pure method of Hahnemann. There's no ideas. There's no conjecture. You take a set of facts. You take and you try to find the most similar set of facts. If you can do that, then you will prescribe the remedy in a certain potency, and you will absolutely see a response of the patient. Absolutely. And if the case is curable in nature, then you will see a very nice curative response. It's very, very simple. So when you say people look to the future, it's because they don't know their past. Because if they knew their past, they don't need to look for tricks, shortcuts, and so on, because there's a pure method. It's been well established, and they probably don't know it. They don't know that method.
Right. Well, that's the thing. I remember reading some of your articles, and you were talking about being a student, and then having a lecture and hearing about something, and then somebody's talking about Herring's law, and then you said, I want to read about that Herring's law. I'll go to the library and I'll look it up. But you said, you couldn't find it anywhere because there was not even one place in any of the literature where he mentioned this is the law. And this, there's a wonderful article on your website about this whole investigation where you wanted to know if it's a law, lots of people must have been talking about it. Everybody must know. It's like, must be some kind of great universal law. And then it turns out he never said that. He never said there was some law, and he certainly didn't make it some kind of universal principle. But every homeopath on earth has learned this law, so-called law, of hearing. If hearing knew about it, his hair would stand up, you know, probably, because he was such a staunch proponent of the inductive method of some kind of rule that fits to everything. He probably would have been very skeptical of that himself. If you knew, when I got to know you, I didn't know anything about hearing, because also another thing is that what happens, I guess, in homeopathy and other traditions as well, is that then people start to use the secondary and tertiary sources. So someone is telling, summarizing what Haring said, and then someone else summarizes what that person says. So they're not actually reading the original. So getting back to Adolf zu Lippe, so he was German. The few little things I know about him, that he was German, that he was from a a royal kind of background, and that he studied medicine in Berlin, and but that he somehow got converted to homeopathy. Do you know how he got interested?
There's nothing in the literature that show how he got converted to homeopathy, and we don't know why he came to Mecca, except that he rejected his nobility title. He was a count. He was eldest son of a count, so he would be the future count, and he preferred to live in a Republican country, so he decided to come to America. But when he came to America, he went to a small town in Pennsylvania, like Reading, Pennsylvania. If you play Monopoly, you would know Reading, because it's one of the first railroad track built in the United States, and it was a railroad track that was built along a river to get some coal from Pottsville upriver. So to bring the coal to boats in Philadelphia and elsewhere. So he went to establish himself. And when he established himself in 1837, he crossed the Atlantic. I found the pass where which boat it was. And he established himself as a homeopathic physician and surgeon. So he had finished his medical school. He put MD, homeopathic physician surgeon. And he must have read a lot of Hahnemann. And we have no knowledge about this. Who was this teacher, or was it just Hahnemann? But soon after arriving, he went to the Allentown Academy to perfect his homeopathic training. And he graduated there. Maybe he entered the academy in 38 and he graduated in 41. But he was still always in Reading to practice. And in the beginning of his practice, well, Lippe was an exceptional practitioner there. In the world of Hahnemannians, whoever knew Lippe knew that he was the practitioner with the greatest success. If you had a difficult case, you go to Lippe. Nash would bring case to Lippe, Helen would bring case to Lippe. So he had unparalleled success, exceptional success, and he himself said, those success was because we follow exactly the Hahnemann method. When you start to not follow the Hahnemann method, that's when the failure comes. That's when you need tricks and shortcuts, and you look in the future to find new ways, new tools, because you don't know the original result, the original way of practicing homeopathy, which is basically the Hahnemann method. A very methodical.
There was some, I think you, I remember you talking about the epidemic that taught him a lot, that, or when he started as a young practitioner, that he was treating a very severe epidemic in Reading.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. When Lippe arrived from America, Europe to America, it was in 1837, he settled in a little town called Reading, Pennsylvania. And if you play Monopoly, you would know where Reading is, because it's one of the corners, I think, of the, not a corner, but one of the middle of the game, because it was one of the first railroad track in the world and in America for sure. And it was to transport coal down to the ocean and Philadelphia. And the railroad track was built along a river, the Susquehanna River, and it was very marshy place, and there was a lot of mosquitoes and there was a lot of malaria. So the workers that worked there, they had a lot of malaria, and they would come to Reading, and Lippe had put this sign, Adolphus Lippe, homeopathic physician and surgeon. So they didn't know there was no homeopathy. Nobody knew about homeopathy, but they say some straggler came to his office and he says he treat them the Alemannian way with a 30 potency. He says rarely he had to give more than one remedy and rarely he had to give more than one dose. And he said he treated them by the hundreds. And well,
what were they suffering from? It was all malaria, severe malaria that was just around from person to person.
Yeah, so it was malaria. And malaria, even modern medicine, when you have a case of malaria, is very difficult. It's not so easy to treat. But it, with homeopathy, it was what single dose. It's a protozoa, you know, it's an you're infected by a protozoa from a, given by a mosquito. And one dose of the remedy, he says, usually was sufficient, and he came by the hundreds. We don't know how many hundreds, but he says he didn't have to. He had not a single failure. But that was the story of his life.
Yeah.
The story of his life is he went through epidemic of smallpox, malignant diphtheria, malignant scarlet fever, where in one epidemic it will come back to me, the third city where he lived. In any case, he had an epidemic of malignant scarlet fever, where he says he treated, I think it was 134 children. He has no death, no sequel, but the allopaths, it was a 95% death rate among the allopaths, and the 5% survived by the allopaths had either damaged heart or damaged brain or damaged kidney. They were damaged. But the case of Lipe had not a single death and, of course, no sequel.
But this, so just exceptional. This is like a moment in history. I mean, it's a local history, but, and it's affecting a small group of people compared to the whole population of the world. But for a local event, this is like a miracle. It seemed to people to be a miracle because the contrast is so strong. I mean, it must have made people absolutely fascinated by Lippe and homeopathy. And they must have wanted to, it must have been just absolutely inspiring to people.
Oh, absolutely. And the population turned into homeopathy. And one of the allopaths in that town, his name was John Armstrong, and he had lost all his case. But when his three children became affected with malignant scarlet fever, guess what he did? And he was the president of the county association of allopaths, and he was a staunch allopath against homeopathy. But when his three children got malignant scarlet fever, guess what he did?
He knocked on Lippe's door.
He knocked on Lippe's door. Lippe treated his three children. They cure. He was fired from being the president of the Allopathic Association because it's like a guilt. You know, he was out of the union, and he left the state and he went to practice in New Jersey, and he practiced homeopathy in New Jersey for the rest of his life. But just to show the incredible success.
But that's the thing,
it's a time that there was no computer, of course, and there was no repertory.
Exactly. And that's I remember you saying in a lecture, just to think about it, at the beginning of homeopathy, there was only one homeopath on earth. There was only one, because we always imagine, there's always been homeopathy or something. It's just one of them. And it could have been forgotten. It could have just been cast aside as thousands of other ideas in the history of medicine. But it was a great idea. It sounded really good. I mean, Herodotus or Hippocrates was talking about it and so on, but that doesn't mean anything. It's just somebody's idea, a nice principle, a philosophical principle. But the success, the actual effect on people's lives, the lives of their children, this must have had such a deep impact on people so that they were even willing to change their complete belief system.
Oh, yeah. At some time, maybe around the third of the century, homeopaths treated about 10% of the US population, 10 to 15%. But their patrons, the patrons of homeopathy, pay one third of the tax in the United States. So one third of the federal tax and county tax and state tax were paid by homeopathic patron or patient. You know, that means the more educated people, the more they would go towards homeopathy and away from allopathy. It was obvious. So anybody that did a bit of inquiry, it was obvious that the facts supported only homeopathy, and that allopathy was a destructive method of treatment.
Well, the thing is, in this is something that keeps coming back, of course, in the history of homeopathy, is then the proportional to the success of homeopathy, it gets allopaths who have not been trained in homeopathy become interested in it, start practicing, or students who are interested in natural medicine or interested in healing will be attracted to homeopathy, not because necessarily it has a nice theory behind it, but because of the practical results. And right. I think that's one of the, it's really interesting to just get a feeling for that, how Lippe was started off because he was following Hahnemann so closely, and he had maybe he had a method we can talk about, a way of doing it, and that his success was just so amazing that it drew people to it, and it changed people's lives, and that had such consequences. It just made waves that have come to up to the present day. I mean, we're talking about him now 200 years later, right?
Right.
So how did it come to be that he came from Germany. So I imagine him in America in this like coal town. He's treating all these workers with malaria, so he's curing. But how did he become well known, or did he start teaching, or how did he become a part of the community with other homeopaths and other healers?
Well, after Hahnemann's death in 1843, Benninghausen, Gross, and Lippe, more or less at the same time, started to use the higher potency, the 200 potency. And Lippe was one of the first to publish his result in journal. And he kept publishing on the higher potency and encouraging his colleagues to use the higher potency because the results were greater. And when I say 200, it was 200, and sometimes 400, sometimes it was 500, sometimes maybe 800 at the beginning. Like we're talking about 1845, 46, and so on. And so Lippe became involved in developing a mathematica in 1851 about. It's called the pharmacodynamics. And he became involved in medical education with Hering, with the Independent Medical School of Pennsylvania. And in 1864, Benninghausen dies. And when Hahnemann died, Hahnemann was strong. He was good. Hahnemann didn't let anybody create a distortion of homeopathy. And he would point out, if you say like this is a hard talk, well, Hahnemann was hard talk. He didn't let anybody pervert pure homeopathy, because he knew the what would happen if you perverted. If you pervert it, you're going to destroy it. If you create confusion, you're going to destroy it. And Benninghausen was the when Hahnemann died in 1843, Benninghausen took that role of defending pure homeopathy. So when somebody started to come with, let's say, combination remedy or multiple remedy, Benninghausen said, this is not homeopathy, call it something else. But Benninghausen died in 64, so 21 years later. So in 64, Lippe wrote a memorial of the death of Benninghausen. And he says, now we're going to have to be more vigilant, because pseudo-homeopaths, people think they know, and they bring new methods and new ideas and shortcuts will attract the people that are not too knowledgeable, and will confuse them, and that will be at the detriment of homeopathy and the people. So Lippi took over the role to defend homeopathy, and he did it until his death in 1888. So he wrote extensively. He wrote maybe one article a month in his professional career, which is quite a lot, to find a homeopath that would write one article a month. And usually the typical article would have clinical case illustration, clinical illustration. But he talked about every subject in homeopathy, but he always have clinical illustration, cure case. And if it was, let's say, and there would be also a big part of his writings was to defend pure homeopathy from pseudo teachers. So right. For instance, a teacher that would show that the way to treat people with malaria is to give them the quinine tincture. It's a non-individual treatment with crude dose, and that would be a teacher in homeopathic medical school. Lippi would right away, when he find out about it, because it would be published in a journal, he would right away write to the journal or write another journal that says, this is not homeopathy, kick him out of the school, get a real teacher there, because you're gonna destroy homeopathy. So he would always be very, very sharp to pick up any deviation from the pure Hahnemannian method.
Right. Well, I think one factor in it, in the whole thing, when you think about the history of homeopathy, when I think about it, Lippe and Hering, so you have Germans who are coming to America. So they were able to read Hahnemann, his lesser writings, his articles, Stapf, and some of his students, Bönninghausen. So they were able to read all that stuff. They were able to access all of that in German. And I don't think there were very little access to all this stuff and to all the literature, to the German literature. It took a long time for translations to be made, and then translations weren't done well, or you know, the translator would add his own thing to it. So these were the days before we could, you know, have access, before homeopaths had access. So I can imagine there were constantly people saying, well, this is the way, this is homeopathy, and this is homeopathy, because who is going to say, who's actually read the original? I remember you telling a story about, you know, up till today, but especially in those days, that no one had ever read the Organon, or they didn't ever even heard of it, even, you know, they hadn't read Hahnemann, they hadn't read what he experienced, they hadn't had the access to the original texts. So there was just room for total free-for-all in that sense. Anyone, he could just say, I'm a homeopath, or I'm doing homeopathic medicine. I mean, today is not that different, because how would a patient know, even, you know, how deeply someone is connected to homeopathy? So I was just thinking as you were talking, why say pure homeopathy? Why can't you just say homeopathy? So maybe you have an answer would it be enough to say we're doing homeopathy, but then we have to add an adjective like Hahnemannian homeopathy or pure homeopathy? But it's actually a bit of a repetition, because homeopathy, let's say, was actually that which Hahnemann discovered and practiced. But maybe it's necessary these days to differentiate by using a word like that.
Hi, homies. I'm sorry to stop the episode here, but the good news is that you can still access the massive discount which Matthias has organized for my listeners, that is you. To listen to the rest of the episode, as well as the entire Network to Heal conference package plus bonus content, visit www.networktoheal.de. You can then select if you want the website in English or German, scroll to the bottom of the page where it says Secure Your Conference Package Now, and enter the discount code Network to Heal 200. Enjoy!